This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books. Chapter 39. Instead of moving on, Mitchell decided to stay put on the island until he had a reason to believe he could surrender without harm. He listened to the news reports through the day and waited for information indicating it was safe for him to turn himself in. Listening to Rookman's show that night gave him second thoughts. Rookman's familiar theme music began, and his gravelly voice started talking.
"Well, folks, what an interesting turn of events out there. Public Enemy Number One, our own little Mad Midge, is now accused of being a one-man weapon of mass destruction. Our own expert on these kinds of things, Dr. Lovestrange, not his real name, is with us on the line from a secret location. Doctor, what do you make of all this?"
Lovestrange spoke in his usual, calm voice.
"Well, Rookman, I have to say one thing. Don't believe it. There's something else going on here. As you know, there's a story they know, and the story they want you to know."
Rookman replied.
"How do you mean? We've said it sounds pretty scary. They've tented up the shopping mall like an exterminator tent, and they're wrapping the super center in plastic. If they're not trying to cause panic, they failed."
"Then explain to me the logic here," said Dr. Lovestrange. "The government is saying that Mitchell has come in contact with a chemical agent that is making people go crazy. Okay, there are two problems here. First, how come Mitchell hasn't gone crazy? Everything I've seen indicates a very sane, rational man trying to run from people pursuing him. Second, what's the logic in creating a WMD that makes people want to kill the person using it? That gives suicide bomber a whole new definition."
"Playing devil's advocate," said Rookman. "What if Mitchell has been given some kind of antidote to this, and the fact that people were attacking him wasn't the intended effect?"
"Possible," said Lovestrange.
"It sounds like a very bad plan. It also brings up another set of questions. Who made this? Everything we worry about terrorists getting a hold of are smaller versions of stuff that we have, like nukes and anthrax. An agent like this is technically way beyond their capabilities and probably most governments. It's also, I might add, illegal under international laws and treaties."
"So who made this?"
asked Rookman. "Certainly not Mitchell acting alone. Three countries have the expertise and weapons programs to make something like this. Russia, China, and the United States. Is Russia or China going to hand over one of their most state-of-the-art chemical weapons to a radio show host to spray in a shopping mall? Why?"
"Maybe it was a test run," said Rookman.
"You don't test run chemical warfare agents. You want to keep a secret inside a foreign country."
"How do you test them?"
asked Rookman, already knowing the answer.
"You do it on your own people," said Lovestrange.
"Wait a minute, Doc. You don't mean to say that our own United States government would use its own citizens to test something like this?"
Rookman exaggerated his disbelief, knowing full well how Lovestrange would respond.
"The CIA exposed subway passengers to an aerosol-based LSD in the 1950s. In the 60s and 70s, we conducted tests to see how quickly bacteria could spread in an urban environment. This is nothing new."
"That was then, Doc. We exposed all that and put a stop to it."
"Did we, Rookman? We did those things when we were acting from fear of a Cold War. After 9-11, we learned a new kind of fear. A whole generation of brilliant minds started imagining all the scary things that bad people could do using genetic engineering, computer viruses, nanotechnology, and 1,000 other techs. Once you start thinking about that stuff, you can't stop wondering about what the other guy's got. Your biggest fear is getting hit by something you don't understand. There's only one way to try to understand these kind of things. First atomic bomb didn't blow up in Hiroshima, Japan. It was detonated in the middle of New Mexico in the United States.
That next day, a radioactive cloud covered half the state, and the public was none the wiser until we dropped the bomb on Japan. Are you saying that this was an intentional test of a weapon by our own government? Asked Rookman. Not a weapon in the traditional sense. This isn't some kind of device used to spray a crowd with crazy gas. The government said chemical agent, which implies a device to distribute it. There is no device. Besides, this isn't a chemical. It's a life form. We're looking at a genetically engineered bacteria or a virus that's causing this. Mitchell is just patient zero. But why didn't it affect him? Asked Rookman. I don't know. In some diseases, you have carriers. Maybe he's just a carrier for it. Somewhere, he got accidentally exposed to it. Maybe he was intentionally exposed, and the people behind this wanted to see what would happen if they sent him into a crowded population. Lovestrange paused. What better way to get rid of a dictator than to have the whole world watch as his people tear him apart on live television? Rookman let out a whistle. That's some serious stuff there, Doctor. So what advice do you have there for a boy? Keep your head down and make sure when you're caught, it's by the right people. And who might that be? Asked Rookman. Not the ones that did this. They get a hold of Mitchell. We're going to hear one side of the story because Mitchell's either going to be vanished down some deep dark hole or be killed in a fake escape attempt. Mitch, if you're out there, trust no one. Only come in when you think it's safe. And if you think they're not being straight with you, run, brother, run. Chapter 40. Up until Rookman's show, the thought that never entered Mitchell's mind, that he was the pawn of some kind of plot. The paranoid yet sane-sounding Dr. Lovestrange had him even more worried. What if he was infected with some kind of secret government experimental virus, he wondered. The scenario Lovestrange laid out, using it to kill a dictator, made a lot of sense to him. Was he really some kind of guinea pig? Mitchell thought about when he'd been sick for the past 2 weeks. Is that an incubation period? Did someone sneak something into his food in his apartment? His mind kept racing with questions. The idea of surrendering no longer sounded as appealing to him. Could he trust the people he surrendered to? If they were the same people who did this to him, who could he trust? His best chance was to make himself look as innocent as possible. He needed to do whatever he could to make sure that in the public's eye, he was a victim and not someone who was part of a terrorist plot. Mitchell decided that when he surrendered, he needed to have an escape route. The surrender point would also be the most public place it could be. He needed to make sure that the things they were going to accuse him of wouldn't hold up in the public's eye. He made his way through the tangled brush in the darkness and out to his boat, pulled off the palm leaves he covered it with, and pushed it back into the water. Mitch pulled the starter cord and drove the boat 5 miles back to the spot he'd seen earlier that morning. It was a medium-sized marina, catering mostly to luxury yachts. Several of them had for sale signs on them, a sign of the Florida economy. One of the things he'd learned when he worked in a marina was that when an owner tried to put a boat up for sale after the first month, they let go any of the crew to save costs. Large vessels weren't as much of a target for theft because it took too long to get them out to sea. There was one noteworthy exception. Mitchell had heard of a man and wife who managed to get a boat all the way to the Bahamas by taking the time to change the name of the boat on the stern and the registration to a similar boat. When Marine Patrol and the Coast Guard saw a vessel that matched the description of the stolen one, they'd run the name and registration and come back with a boat that wasn't reported missing. The biggest problem was fuel. Any boat he found wasn't likely to have enough on board to get very far. That wasn't going to be a problem for Mitchell. He didn't need to go too far with the boat. Mitchell drove his little boat into the harbor and started looking at the different boats. He drove by one 200-foot yacht that still had its lights on. It was obviously occupied, not the ideal boat for Mitchell, but it gave him an idea. He pulled out the iPod he'd stolen and turned it on. Sure enough, the yacht had an open Wi-Fi connection. Mitch pulled up a web page showing a list of all the yachts and powerboats in the area that were up for sale, along with all their features. Originally, he thought about just stealing a luxury yacht and waiting for SWAT to storm the boat if the surrender didn't go right. But then he had another idea. Why not just get a large powerboat instead? He'd never be able to outrun the full force of the federal government, but at least he could buy some time. Mitch began looking up listings for fast boats, the kind Scarface would want to use. One in particular caught his eye. It was a model that wasn't too obscure and would be easy to mark up as another vessel if he got the tools to do it. What really stood out was a piece of equipment that it came with. Mitch had to have it. Mitch put the iPod away and patrolled the marina until he found the vessel. The vessel had Highlander written across the stern. It was a 40-foot Donzi. He climbed over the transform and lifted the covering area that was buttoned over the cockpit area. He slid underneath. There were rows of seats in back and two chairs in front. The boat was intended for two things, scuba diving and going really fast. It was the kind of boat you'd take for an overnight diving trip to the Bahamas or the Keys to bring back a lobster or 100 kilos of cocaine. The control console was covered with a metal sheet that was locked into place with a thick lock. The entrance to the main cabin had a similar lock. Mitchell could see that there was no way he was going to be able to use his tire iron to pry the locks off. He was also certain that he wasn't going to find a spare key hidden in the deck. If he could get past the lock on the cabin, he was sure he'd be able to get inside and get the lock console and the key for the ignition. He looked at the lock on the cabin again. Bolt cutters wouldn't do it. He'd need a power tool. Mitch peeked out under the covering and looked at the dock in front of the boat. He'd see a power outlet. He needed a metal grinder. He took out the iPod and opened up the Wi-Fi panel. He was still getting signal from the large yacht. Mitch pulled up a list of nearby super centers. Made a mental shopping list. Chapter 41. His last raid had been an act of improvisation. He'd been able to outrun the old greeter and get to where he needed and get some of the things he wanted. Items like the paintball gun and a few other things were useless to him in the store that prior night while still in their packages. Mitchell had come to realize that when people raged out and went homicidal, they lost whatever kind of control that made them rational and capable of planning. He hadn't seen anyone throw punches or try any stylized fighting technique. This gave him some advantage. He could predict how they'd come at him. At least he thought he could. While he now had more insight and preparation to help him, he was going to need a little more than a paintball gun and pepper spray. This store had a police car parked in the curb out front, a precaution that was undoubtedly influenced by the previous night's raid on the store 40 miles to the south. Mitchell looked at the car from the row of hedges and faced the store. He contemplated walking the 3 blocks to where he'd parked his John boat in a canal and making other plans. The cop car meant at least one armed police officer, maybe more. "Fuck me," said Mitchell. Couldn't get the idea out of his head. Bad things only happened to him when he was ashore. Previous night, he'd been lucky with the deputy who got caught off guard. This time, there was someone waiting for him. There were a few cars in the parking lot. Nothing screamed, "Unmarked police car." Mitchell pulled the scanner from his pocket and turned it to the frequency he found on radioreference.com. He listened for a half hour while watching the parking lot. He heard various dispatches to different areas of the city, but nothing that sounded like it was near him. If there was some kind of covert surveillance going on, it was likely they were using scrambled frequencies. The scanner could only tell him what was going out over the public frequencies. If the cop parked in front of the store called for more units, he could hear that. The sooner they could tell him where the dispatcher was trying to coordinate police cars to find him if the call went in. Mitchell decided that the car was there as it had turned, and not as part of a stakeout. There were just too many supercenters in South Florida for that to be practical. Other than the cop inside the car, it wasn't likely there was a police presence. Of course, one cop was enough to deal with. The safest bet was to take the police officer out of the picture. If he walked near the car, he ran the risk of the officer raging out and trying to kill him, possibly shooting him. If he was spotted from too far away, the officer was likely to call it in. Since Mitchell was the target of the largest manhunt in the nation's history, it was easy to assume that there were a lot more police out there that night than usual. You'd expect backup to arrive on the scene very quickly. He needed a distraction that would let him get into the store unnoticed.
problem was getting by the inevitable greeters, which, if the store had any sense, weren't going to be as feeble as they were the night before. The best approach would be to walk to the main entrance as casually as he could and enter in plain sight of the police officer. From there, he'd have to take care of the greeter and run into the store, get what he needed, and then exit through the back. Without any fellow shoppers trying to kill him, he could probably be in and out in under 2 minutes. With any luck, he could be back to the boat before the police knew he was there. Counting on luck wasn't something he planned on doing. He needed to figure out a way to create some. Mitch rehearsed where he needed to go and walked across the parking lot to the entrance. He used an earbud to listen to the scanner in his back pocket under his jacket. The paintball gun was tucked into his wristband, along with a can of pepper spray. He was in full-on Mitch mode. He reached the last row of cars before crossing the road in front of the store. Through the glass doors, he could see a man about his height and a stocky build acting as the greeter. Mitch began to bring his hands toward the can of mace. As the doors whisked open, he shot a glance into the police car. It was empty. That wasn't good. The doors opened, and the greeter looked at him. Mitch gave him a nod. The greeter was halfway into returning the nod when his face changed. Mitchell pulled the pepper spray out with his right hand and shot him in the face with a blast. "Sorry, bud!" The greeter screamed, then wiped instinctively at his eyes. His arms lashed out, trying to find him. Mitch ducked under his grasp and ran past him into the store. The young man in his teens with a shaved head and a pierced lip looked out from over the checkout counter and came toward him. Mitch switched the pepper spray into his left hand and pulled out the paintball gun. He fired 2 balls into the young man's face, covering his eyes with paint. The cashier, a thin woman with a long ponytail, jumped up on the counter and snarled. Mitch shot her once in the face before she leaped up at him. The paintball didn't faze her. He shot her in the eyes with a pepper spray and continued running to the store. She fell on her side, knocking over a candy rack, and screamed. Where was the police officer? His head Mitchell worried. The cops saw him from far enough away and told him to freeze. He could drop him with 1 bullet if Mitch tried to run. While the rage made people more deadly with their own bodies at short range, they seemed to lose all mechanical aptitude for things like door handles and guns. Mitch ran to the hardware department. As he ran past rows of shelves, he shot a quick glance for other shoppers and to look for the cop. Not that he wanted to run into him. He just needed to know where he was. Mitch reached the hardware section and grabbed a bucket to throw stuff in. The paint he needed was behind glass. Mitch placed the pepper spray and paintball gun into the bucket and picked up a ladder. Smashed the front of the case, sending sharp glass shards everywhere. He grabbed a few different colors, including the one he needed. He ran down another aisle and found an angle grinder. Mitchell impulsively reached for the cheapest one before Mitch reminded himself that price really wasn't an option at this point in time. He ran to another aisle and grabbed an extension cord. Poked his head around the main aisle and saw the greeter, the pierced teenager, and the cashier running in his direction. It was clear they couldn't see where they were going, but they were going on something else, most likely Mitchell's scent, and it was driving them forward. Mitch ran back the opposite way and took the aisle farthest from them. He was about to go into the boating section to grab letters for the powerboat, then froze. Cursed himself for being so stupid. If he grabbed boat letters, they'd know that night what he was up to. There'd be every police swarming every marina as soon as they saw the surveillance video and looked at what he stole. He needed to think of something else to use that wouldn't be obvious. He ran back down the aisle he just came from, and ran face first into the stocky greeter. The man's thick fingers grabbed him by the neck. Mitch kicked him in the balls as hard as he could. The greeter didn't flinch. The teenager with the piercing lunged at Mitchell, grabbing him around the waist. The three of them fell to the ground. Mitch managed to knee the teenager in the chin and then kicked him in the chest, sending him backwards. The greeter was still choking Mitchell and bringing his teeth in to bite him. Mitch's hands grabbed at the shelves, trying to find something to use as a weapon. He felt a heavy box and grabbed it. He slammed it into the side of the greeter's face as hard as he could. The greeter didn't relent. Mitch hit him again, just above the eye, splitting it open. Blood poured down his face, but he didn't stop. Mitch brought his knees up to his chest and kicked out at the man. He kept his legs pressed against the other man and kept shoving. He finally slipped out of his grasp.
Mitch scrambled backwards on the floor on his backside and looked for something else to use as a weapon. The teenager crawled towards Mitchell's foot, and Mitch kicked him in the face. The greeter jumped at Mitchell again. This time, Mitch pulled himself to the side by grabbing the edge of the shelf. The man hit the tile next to him. Mitch used his free hand on the shelf to pull him up. As he leaned on it, the shelf came loose and fell on top of the greeter, sending a pile of toolboxes on him. That wasn't going to stop him. Mitch looked at the box in his hands. Was it for a kitchen fire extinguisher? Mitch pulled it out of the box and yanked the safety free. He sprayed the other men directly in their faces, covering them in a cloud of white powder. Mitch found his bucket of stolen merchandise and ran to another section. He found some rolls of black electrical tape and shoved them into the bucket. He stepped out onto the aisle and saw the ponytailed cashier approaching. Mitch pulled out the paintball gun and shot her twice in the face, and then ran back to the automotive section. 5 more people were coming from the other side of the store. They were 30 yards away and gaining. Mitch looked around for another weapon. There was a stack of motor oil to his left. He sat down his bucket and pulled a fish knife from his waistband. He started stabbing holes in cans and throwing them between himself and the people running at him. A heavy man in a football jersey ran over one of the cans and his heel slipped down on the oil. He lost his balance and pulled down a display of 2-liter soda bottles with him. A tall stock clerk jumped over the oil spill and came charging at Mitchell. Mitch grabbed a can from the display and just hurled it at his head. The can hit the man in the cheek, but he kept running. Mitch threw another can at his head and missed. Desperate, Mitch slid the whole display of motor oil on the ground, covering the closing gap between them. The man's foot slipped on one of the cans and his face slammed into the pile with so much force, a can popped open, spewing oil like a blood splatter. Mitch could see the other people getting closer. He wouldn't be able to fight them all off. He ran toward a pair of double doors in the back of the store. He entered a long storeroom. He felt a shudder as he remembered what happened the day before in the department store. Mitch wanted to block the doors, but he didn't see anything. So he ran down the aisle, pulling large boxes onto the floor behind him. Halfway to the exit, he could hear the double doors open behind him. The pursuer struggled through the boxes. To Mitch's right, he saw a fire axe and a fire hose. He reached for the axe, then noticed an electrical power box. Mitch set down his bucket and used 2 hands to slam the axe into the cable above the power box. The lights went off. He could hear footsteps and snarling getting closer. Fuck! Mitchell realized that they didn't need sound to find him. They could follow his scent. He was blind. They weren't. Mitchell held the axe ready to slam it into anything that came close. Damn it! He knew that hitting someone with a blade would kill them, self-defense or not. That would be murder. Mitchell turned the axe around so the blade was under his hand. He used it like a club, not a bladed weapon. Concussions were fair game. Mitchell heard a box crunch near him. He swung into the dark and felt the handle connect. Something fell backwards. He heard something to his right. He swung again. He heard a crack and felt a spray of blood hit him in the face and his open mouth. He spat it out. Something grabbed his ankle. Mitchell brought his foot up and slammed down on the hand. He could feel the bones crunch under his heel. He felt around and grabbed the bucket. Mitchell slid around the back wall, periodically jabbing the axe handle into the darkness. He felt it connect again. Something clicked behind him. He stopped for a moment, then realized it was the back exit. Mitchell bolted through and almost dropped the axe. There was a police car in back of the store. Mitchell froze until he heard footsteps behind him. He shoved the door closed. Fists slammed against it from the other side. Mitch picked up the axe and slammed it into the middle of the door, just below waist height. He ignored the cop car as he tried to shut the door. The axe lodged in a wedge-shaped gash. Mitch pushed down on the edge of the handle until it hit the ground. Hands behind the door found the release and pushed the door open. The axe slid backwards a few inches, then came to a stop when it hit the metal railing that lined the walkway behind the door. Mitch looked over at the second cop car. It had to have been empty. No one was trying to kill him. He hopped over the railing and landed on the hood. He had the impulse to slash the tires, but decided it wasn't worth losing time. Mitchell took his bucket and ran toward the boat. He could still hear the dispatchers and police officers on the scanner talking, but nothing about the store. He considered that a good thing. He was nervous that he hadn't seen the 2 cops anywhere inside the store. Mitchell ran two more blocks and found his boat where he left it. He threw his stolen booty into it and kicked off from the canal, gave the engine a start, and headed back to the marina. On the way back, he realized that, in fact, he had seen the cops. He understood why his nut kick didn't have any effect. The stocky greeter was one of the cops. When Mitch kicked him in the testicles, he probably kicked him where he had his gun hidden. The other cop was probably disguised as one of the store clerks, most likely the Hispanic one that kept coming. Felt good about narrowly averting a close call with the cops, and also for not doing permanent damage to the man's balls. No matter how sore Mitchell's throat felt, he knew he couldn't blame the man for trying to kill him. What did make Mitchell upset was the fact that if the cops were waiting for him to show up, how come none of them had any kind of protective gear like gas masks on them? For sure, if they did, Mitch would be in custody or dead right now. But if they still weren't taking him seriously, he was even more worried about surrendering. For all the effort he just went through, and all the bruises on his neck and the rest of his body, Mitchell was glad that he was going to take some extra steps to protect himself when he surrendered. The crazy James Bond shit Mitch had planned probably wouldn't work. It would only get him killed. But at least he wouldn't go down easy. All hell broke loose.
This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook Store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.